You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Well, hello out there in podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for episode 163 of your Rock Art Podcast. Wow. What a concept. We are blessed to have Jake Settlemyer from the University of Tennessee. Jake, are you with me?
I am with you. It's good to hear you again, Alan.
Yes, it's good to be heard. And we're gonna have a wonderful conversation because Jake is a unique resource. He is a bibliophile of the first order, a researcher premier on indigenous theology worldwide relating to animal ceremonialism. And that has been a topic on our podcast at various times and places. So we're going to talk about some of Dr. Settlemyer's discoveries, the character of his research, what he's working on now, what he'll be working on soon, and in general, just find out more about Dr. Settlemyer, Jake, and how he does what he does. Jake, I kick it off with the million-dollar question. How the heck did you ever get involved in such an esoteric topic as animal ceremonialism worldwide, globally?
That's a very good question. Well, I have a background in evolutionary biology, and I began my career as a paleontologist working on dinosaurs, especially dinosaur head evolution, but much earlier. I began with a degree in religious studies. It was coupled with a degree in psychology. I had considered going to Divinity School, and I had applied to, at one point in my life, Harvard Divinity School. Man. And I've always had this interest then in the components of origins of human religions. And, you know, partly as a zoologist, our human interactions with non-human entities such as animals. And so that has led me to where we are now. Eventually, you know, I had looked through a lot of the literature, translated a lot of it, and I kept starting up a database of particular concepts, ideas, archaeological sites, and such. And it ultimately turned into this project I've developed, this Embodied Essence Project.
And what is the Embodied Essence Project?
Well, the Embodied Essence Project is this idea that it's derived from the ideas of Robert Broxton Onions, who is a very interesting individual. He was considered a classicist. He had a position teaching Latin at the University of London. And he wrote his magnum opus in 1951, which is a really incredible piece of work that virtually nobody knows anything about. It's almost never, ever referenced. And it was a major influence on me.
How long is this magnum opus of this seminal researcher?
Okay, so his work was entitled, it's very Darwinian in the title, The Origins of European Thought, about the body, the mind, the soul, the world, time, and fate.
Yeah. You don't want to take too much of the, you know, off your platter, do you? You want to go for the whole enchilada.
And it's mainly people that do reference it, typically reference it in the context of Greek and Roman cultures. Okay. And that was part of the focus that he had. But in the end, it was a much more universal look that he took. He covered Semitic cultures. He covered other Indo-European cultures. He did work on the Paleolithic. And his idea was, personally, I think, as somebody who's familiar with theological thought, postmodernist theory, whatnot, that Onions' work is probably one of the most important research that has ever been done on religion and the meaning of religion. And it's really sad that like so few people are aware of it.
Yeah. So given it's such an apex study, give us some tidbits of why you believe it's so important, and what did he say?
Well, what Onions was saying is that in a lot of cultures, and very much in our Indo-European culture originally, that the essence, the animating force of us and of existence, of other animals, is found within body parts and within bodily fluids. And especially what he called muelos, which was marrow, which was seen as being basically flowing almost like a serpent through the vertebral column as the spinal cord. And it flew from where it was produced in the brain, what the Chinese actually once in Chinese alchemy termed the sea of marrow. And this was considered to be this regenerative soul. And it was referred to as psyche. In Roman, it is known as the genius, which gives us also concepts like the genie. And that would flow then into fat and other substances that are bring about life. In one case, it very importantly, is that there was considered to be these occult veins that drain from the spinal cord into the testes, and that was where the origin of semen came from. So ultimately, okay, it all came from brain, which was the origin of marrow. And that a lot of religion is attempting to acquire that vital essence or maintain it or to pass it on. So there's this idea that he had, and it gets very complex, and I'm not going to get into this, of different forms of spirit types and soul essences as expressed in like what he considered to be thymus, which is kind of like a blood breath.
Yeah.
But a lot of this is in the marrow, which is the seed, and that marrow is found in bone.
Was he saying that physiologically, if you examine the, you know, the internal structure of a human being, that somehow these fluids within our body are animating or origin points or sort of they have a great influence on the way we believe in religious precepts, or am I completely wrong?
No, you're essentially right. He was saying that people believed that these fluids were basically spiritual essences.
Okay.
Or body parts.
Yeah.
And so like the fact that it's in the marrow is very important. So the marrow is embedded in bone. And this gives you the idea that like in a lot of cultures, it's almost like bone is a seed. So when a person or an animal dies, one way of either propitiating the master of animals or of giving respect to the animal that has been killed or whatnot is to basically bury or deposit or specially treat those bones, because that's where the life essence is. And if you want the organism to come back, if you want it to be regenerated, if you want to have renewal of the species, that is basically
it. Now I'm getting it. So the life essence is in the bones.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, and that's the marrow.
Yes.
And it gives us this idea of like, you know, bonfires during, you know, during annual spring ceremonies and stuff where it actually, you know, comes from bone fire. You deposit the bones in there. It's considered to split the seed open, and that releases the essence of life. And that would fertilize the crops and such. So that becomes in like an agricultural setting, how these kind of like ideas developed. Okay. But they're very much at the essence of what the Vienna School in mid 20th century, which very few people are aware of anymore, called Tiernachen, this idea of animal bones and the essence of life in there. And that a lot of hunter-gatherer rituals and ceremonies are focused on animal body parts and fluids in order to regenerate them. And Onions covered this in unbelievable number of ways.
So one of the things that this brings up or sort of comes about was that wonderful paper that recognized the caching of animal parts still to this very day in caves. I believe it's amongst the Maya.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Correct. Yeah. And it's in Guatemala. It is in caverns.
Yeah.
They deposit mostly, again, cephalic parts, head parts.
Yes.
So skulls, mandibles, that sort of thing. Horns are especially important as being outgrowths of the soul substance.
Okay, let's not skip on that. I think this might be a place to at least segue shortly, but I'd like to know why the bones, why are they cached? You mentioned the animal master. I don't think our audience knows exactly about that, yes and no, but why are the bones cached? Why are they selectively cached? And I think we'd like to, you know, at least touch upon those questions and more. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. We're on segment two, Dr. Alan Garfinkel interviewing Dr. Settlemyer from the University of Tennessee, talking about all them bones. Them bones, them dry bones.
Jake, and blood.
Bones and blood.
Semen. Blood, you know, blood is life.
Yeah, blood is life. So where do we go from here? What are you telling us about what is an animal master? Why cache bones? Why be selective about those bones? And what does all this imply about the religious life of the indigenous people?
Well, okay, so when you talk about the concept of animal master, sometimes people call them lord of animals, and that's kind of like this concept that was overwritten under a feudalist society in Siberia, where it's hierarchical. But it is an other than human entity that basically is in charge of either all animals or a particular species, and it sees to its well-being and it protects them. And so hunters need to propitiate this entity or entities in order to make sure that they get a kill, that they are able to acquire game. And that animal species or that individual itself will regenerate. And sometimes it's to propitiate, it is the organism itself that has soul essence. And so it's making sure that, like, basically that animal is resurrected. So there's multiple different ways that different cultures basically view this. And one of the structures that is most important are cephalic structures, head structures. And that would be the mandible or any, the cranium or anything that is an outgrowth of it.
So, and why the cranium? Why the hair?
Because in many cultures, the head seems to have been seen as where the life force is most concentrated, most centered. And part of that could be from the brain. I mean, ultimately, because the brain is in there. And ultimately, I think if we're trying to come up where, like, where did this all come from? I mean, it makes sense that if you're coming from a hunter-gatherer, ancient ancestry, that it is the body parts and fluids of animals that bring about life for you, for the family, for the tribe. And that life is embodied in particular structures. And so one of the most nutritious structures that you can eat from an animal is the brain. It's highly rich in fat. And in most foraging cultures, it's fat more than anything else that you want.
Wow.
And so fat itself, like, and bone grease and such, are considered to be extremely potent, as well as...
When you say extremely potent, you mean spiritually and supernaturally and powerful.
Absolutely. And so I had come up with basically like an 11-point series of core principles that I think underlie hunter-gatherer religion. And then were ultimately these concepts were then adapted as people adapted, as different peoples adapted to new socio-ecological conditions. And so
now those 11 principles, those 11 takeaways, is that based on a region, a country?
No, I believe it's basically a cross-cultural perspective.
Global.
Yeah. So like my eighth tenet was that the core focus of religion concerns life, death, rebirth, and the acquiring of vital potency.
That sounds like shamanism.
Well, yes. And that becomes part of it. And that is part of like the ninth principle is that essential to the hunting ritual drama, because it is a ritual drama between the hunter and the prey, is to acquire vital force potency from the consumption of the killed animal or the person.
Wow.
And those dramas are often elaborated in animal ceremonialism, and that could take the form of sacred prey animals or powerful predators, or in the cases of humans as headhunting or exocannibalism. And ultimately, so that leads to like my 10th principle, which is that the circulating potency of cosmic vital force then gets translated into fertility, fecundity, game, and world renewal.
What is this vital force you've alluded to?
The vital force is the spirit essence.
Ah.
So it could be like what we can think about in some people have called like mana.
Right.
It is the essence of being.
Now, amongst the Numic, there's a thing they call puha or buha.
It's that concept.
It is that concept.
Absolutely. Yes.
And is there something in the Jewish religion as well that some kind of vital essence, right? Some sort of,
yes.
Yeah.
And that is in blood and the breath.
The blood and the breath.
Yeah. In ancient Hebrew philosophy, it is the nefesh is yep. one of these nefesh. Concepts.
And in the breath is life. The word for breath. The word for life.
Absolutely.
What's the word for breath? Do you know? In Hebrew? Yeah.
I do know this, but
yeah, I can't put my finger on it either, but I know that particular word is a powerful one because it integrates with the Holy Spirit.
Yes.
Breath.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
And think about it too. The sacrum and caudal vertebrae in Hebrew theology was also very powerful. That this was so a lot of times when you look at it, it is the ends of like the backbone, the head and the tail that really concentrate that soul essence. And that is definitely in Hebrew religion. When you think about the importance of the sacrum, and also when you think about, you know, in the Maccabean Second Temple Judaism, when the Temple of Jerusalem basically an entire economy, for the most part, I mean, I'm a little bit of over-exaggerating, was based upon animal sacrifice.
Yes, it was.
And it was, again, it was focused mostly on goats.
Yeah.
And one of the important things is you go into the Holy of Holies is that the person places their head upon the goat before slitting its throat. And the purpose of that is to transfer the sins of the individual into the goat.
Yes.
And then when the goat dies, it gets released in the blood, basically.
Oh, my word. So you're transferring your sin away. You're releasing and you're gathering the moral high road from doing that,
yes.
right? Yes. Okay.
And so there become so many different reasons like why beheading and such happens in animal sacrifices or with human sacrifices, whatnot. And that's just one variant of it. When you talk about ancient Egyptian religion, there was the ritual beheading that started in the New Kingdom and probably had earlier precedent of ritual beheading of antelopes. And that was because the desert was considered to be the enemy of life. And antelopes were denizens of the desert. They were incarnations of the evil one, of Seth, who stand in opposition to the eye of Horus and prevented the sun from being reborn.
Yes.
And so by going on a ritual hunt, capturing these animals, bringing them into the temple, and especially the oryx, which was definitely considered to be a truly evil animal, a Sethian animal, beheading that is basically you're conquering death. You're conquering the chaos. This is, you know, the concept of Mott.
Well, we're talking about Easter.
Yes.
So the resurrection, when Jesus came and died for our sins, he conquered sin and death. And by his resurrection, he took away all of our sins. Sounds familiar?
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, this was not something I was planning on talking about.
No, I know.
But if you think about going back to ancient Judaism and you think about how the Second Temple culture was, and also, you know, continuing under Roman occupation,
right.
One could see Christianity as being born within the context and from the context of a culture based upon animal sacrifice.
Yeah, and I can see that.
You have Yeshua ben Yosef coming into the temple and knocking over the money changers. Yeah. So you don't bring in this idolatry to buy the animals.
I think the Hebrew words were Ruach HaKodesh.
It was Ruach and Nefesh, yes.
Yes, okay.
The blood and the breath.
So if the premise is, if the tail is one of those key conduits, right, that you said had such importance, then obviously my working hypothesis about the orientation of that tail
and
the openness to reproduction and fertility and...
Without question.
So please explain that to me, because that was a very difficult concept for many people to really digest and believe. Why would the tail be such an important... The tail on a bighorn sheep is the least important piece of that animal.
Because the lifting of the tail gives access to the vulva.
Yes.
Right? It allows for copulation.
Right.
And that leads to reproduction. And that leads to regeneration.
Right.
Of the species, of the individual, of the family.
Right. So it's about... So really the life concepts is regeneration, renewal, rebirth, all that. And that makes sense to me.
Right.
It really does.
And that's why you frequently see an association of horned animals with goddesses or female fairies. Hmm. I found this everywhere. Amerindian cultures are a little bit different because it's not so clear. But ibex, just about ibex worship or ibex ceremonialism, exists everywhere from ancient Egypt and across Eurasia into Mongolia, Tibet, and then on the opposite end into Europe in the Pyrenees and into the Alps. And in many of these cases, female fairies or goddesses are associated with those ibexes. And it helps, it's part of this sacred marriage in a sense that brings about like rain and fertility. And that's why, well, it's a very long discussion. It could be its own program, actually.
Right. Well, this is fantastic. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, with the Wild and Willy, Dr. Jake Settlemyer. And we're on a wild ride, folks, a global understanding of the origins of religion and an understanding of indigenous cultures who are foragers and how they think, what they think about, and why they sacrifice animals.
Yeah, so I do want to mention that as part of this, me and Bria McCauley, who is as Simon Fraser, she's a graduate student about ready to get her PhD, and did a great study on rock art and finger amputation that was published that I think you'd love to have her as a guest. And
sure.
Anyway, we just did a meta-analysis of close to 300 different cultures and located them by ethnolinguistic group and geographical setting. And their concepts of like this embodied essence, what body parts are ensouled with spirit or vital force. And that hopefully will be a chapter in this book that is being developed on this concept. Anyway, so to get back on this acquiring of energy from animals, that gets me to like my 11th and final point was that these interactions, those ceremonies and such, or transferences, rituals, transformations, manipulations, the possession, propitiation, are of a shamanic nature, and they're frequently mediated through ensouled anatomical parts and substances. And that even includes representations of a being or its body parts. And that can be in the form of images, say rock art, petroglyphs, ceramics, figurines, performative mimicry, effigies, fetishes, idols. Body parts can then be used to take the power and essence of or absorb special qualities from particular animals, their speed, their ferocity, their strength, which is why, like with the Bushmen, young males, when they have their first hunt, if they want to be fast, you can do scarification and put ash from that animal, like a springbuck that's fast, into that, and you incorporate its soul into you. And so you can transform into part of or all of different animals or dependent upon the parts. So specific and soul body parts or their figurative representations, these can be talismans or amulets. And ultimately, the soul or spirit of an animal or person can be contained, trapped, transferred into body parts. And these can be carried, placed on altars, incorporated into bundles or other sacra, such as, you know, these are the mandibles, skulls, and other bones. These are representations of animals, entities, or spirits in the form of fetishes and such.
Yes.
Or spirit animals.
Right. So what we're leading to, in part, is one of the mysteries that you and I have spoken about, the caching of an infinite number of skulls, crania, horns, etc., in these tanks, in these natural crevices that were seen by the Spaniards when they came to the Southwest. When they interviewed the natives there, they asked them, why are you doing this? And they said, so the breath would not leave that area.
Right.
What do they mean by that, Doctor?
The life force and that generates these animals, the animating force.
Wow.
And we find this all over the place. I just came across this very similar ritual cave in Japan that is filled with sero deer and such, especially their skulls, that looks very much like the Mayan situation. And it can take different forms. In Kafiristan, which is now in Pakistan with the Kalasha people who are, you know, an early, well, they're maybe kind of like a vestigial Indo-Aryan people. There's this great fissure in the earth that is considered to be the dragon's backbone. And in it, Dupre, when he was studying it, found thousands, if not more, of ibex skulls and other bones that had been deposited in there.
Wow.
They've been given to the earth, basically. And I wish, you know, like his ethnography that he had asked more, you know, what does this fully mean? What happens, you know, what do these, giving these bones essentially to the dragon, what does that actually mean?
But, and in your model, in your studies, how do you explain that?
How do I explain what is happening with them?
Yeah.
I believe it's this underlying idea that you're bringing back the animal through its parts. Those parts have their essence in it, their soul substance, their spirit. And it was believed that animating principle then can return if it's treated respectfully and correctly.
That sounds exactly like the Numic, because we're talking about, unless you treat the skull and the horns, the head of this animal, with respect, that animal master is going to get pissed off,
right?
And you're not going to have animals to hunt.
Right. Or the species master, or the individual animal itself.
Yes.
Will be upset and not come back.
Right.
And sometimes its spirit can thwart you. So there's this concept, very complex concept in Africa. It's almost pan-African, called Nyama, which is that essence can take on a revenge force that can hurt the hunter, that can hurt people that do harm to the individual that was killed. And this is why they specially treat body parts there. So elephant trunks were considered to be very dangerous. They called it oftentimes the elephant's hand. And you think about it's almost like a horror movie. You have this disembodied trunk that can regenerate, come back alive, and do harm to you. Because, you know, the trunk's end, it's prehensile. It's like a hand to them. And so what they would do is they would cut off the trunk from the rest of the head. And you still see this in poaching photography, photographs of poachers and such, with the elephants that have been left on the savannah. Or they would cut off the tip of the trunk and they would bury it. They would also do this with the trigeminal nerve within the tusk. They would extract that and they would bury it, because those were considered to be extremely potent and dangerous. And if you did not bury them in a particular way, with a particular kind of ceremony, they would come back, or the spirit of the elephant would come back, or the master of elephants would come back, or the deity that is associated with elephants would come back. It's a revenge.
So what is it about the horns and those antlers that causes these hunters to want to adorn themselves with those particular embellishments?
Because they're considered filled with life force. And you know, when you look at funeral rituals of all over the world in which you have artiodactyls, ruminants, horned ruminants, people were oftentimes buried with antlers or horns. And that was, it was likely this concept ultimately, it might have gotten abstracted and forgotten eventually why it was done. But the original concept, most likely based upon our understanding of the, you know, from the comparative ethnographic record, was to bring life force to that individual, to help them to come back and to carry into the afterlife. But my studies are finding that these funereal rituals are far more complex than just that. That different animals that are deposited with people, even of the same species, can have different purposes. So in Tibet, from the ancient funereal manuscripts that we have, some of the sheep or other horned animals, typically in the form of rams and such, that are buried with the dead, were meant as psychopomps. They helped to lead to the afterlife. Some were soul carriers. In fact, the person could be transferred, their soul could be put into that animal that would then go to the afterlife. Or some of them with their horns, and you see this a lot, this idea that horns were filled with flames, the dead animal, and that they could then get through this kind of like war that is the afterlife, to get to the afterlife, that there's a battle, and that it kills demons along the way. And so some of those animals are to protect against demons. And it's the horns that do that.
So the Great Mural Rock Art in Baja has some of the largest paintings in the world.
Yes.
Here's these pictures of people, monos or some sort of, you know, you can call them shamanistic ancestor deities or something like that. And they have their hands up towards the sky.
Yes, that Orante.
Right, and they're looking at us. But next to them, animals are on a tear running towards the heavens. What do you make of that?
I'd have to see the actual image that you're actually specifically referring to. I know the area, and I know what these look like. They're huge.
But if I pressed you and I said, come on, tell me what's going on there, what would you say?
A lot of times we do find, and we find this in Khoisan cultures, we find in Nilotic cultures, there seems to have been the case in ancient Egypt and other areas that these raised arms basically mimic horns. And there are dances in which the people are mimicking. It's like almost like a therianthropic transformation.
Yes.
In which they are becoming that animal. And I mean, we could do a whole program on this, but it's interesting that it's been held over in the strangest fashions, because you still see it. It's kind of like this sacred marriage kind of like thing in the bullfight, where you have the matador with his arms raised against the bull.
Yeah.
And then that is also reflected in the flamenco dance, in which they both take on the forms of cattle. They put their arms up in this ritual display, with their hands up in a ritual display of horns. And they basically, one is the bull and one is the cow. And even with the coloring that the women dance with, the red flamenco dance dress.
So in the last 2 minutes of our current episode, what's the takeaway from all this? What should we think about or know or understand? How would this affect us in terms of giving us insight or wisdom or a better knowledge or something that we learned, a bit of discovery what do you want them to know?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, in the end, I think what we need is more data from a comparative perspective.
Sure.
And that's what we're doing. My group is doing is we're putting together a huge database across cultures, from archaeology, ethnography, from folklore, all of these things. And then to search for the patterns or to see, like, what are the differences? And, you know, is this an ecological thing or whatnot? But I think the answer is going to be complex, but I think we're also going to see a lot of commonalities that one wouldn't expect to have seen. And I think that
if someone asked me, I'd say it shows how similar people are the world over, no matter if they're 100,000 years ago or just yesterday?
And I'm not sure we fully know what the questions are yet.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's important, is that we first need to know where all the bodies are buried.
Yeah.
Where and how, in order to ask why, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
And that's part of like what we're working on at this point from multiple dimensions. That's what I was really happy about the Embodied Essence Symposium that we did, is that we got people that were philosophers, folklorists, archaeologists, anthropologists, ethnographers, people that would never have interacted with each other, that were working on very similar questions or very similar concepts to one another.
So the answer to that conclusion is by having a multidisciplinary group and asking the right questions,
right,
we gain an insight on who we are and who our ancestors were.
Exactly. And I'm hoping that this becomes kind of a sub-discipline.
Amen.
Yeah.
Okay. Stick a fork in me because I'm done.
All right. Well, this is a lot of fun. Thank you, Alan.
Goodbye, gang. See you in the flip-flop.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.